Herbert Nielsen, director of the Botany Institute at Lund University, said, "My attempt to demonstrate evolution by an experiment carried on for more than 40 years, and this guy believed in it when he started, has completely failed. It is not even possible to make a caricature out of evolution by the paleobiological facts. The fossil material is now so complete that the lack of transitional series cannot be explained as due to the scarcity of the material. The deficiencies are real, they will never be filled, and the idea of evolution rests purely on belief." And I want you to understand that, because, beloved, I want you to understand that evolution is a science, or rather is a religion. It is based on belief. I'd like to read to you just two more real quickly. John T. Bonner, eminent biologist, wrote in a review of Kirkett's book, "This book has a disturbing message. It points out some unseemly cracks in the foundations of evolution. One is disturbed because what is said gives us the uneasy feeling we knew for a long time deep down inside, but we were never willing to admit, even to ourselves." That's in the review of Kirkott's book, American Scientist, volume 49, 1961. Lauren Isley, anthropologist, says this, "With the failure of many efforts to create life, science was left in the embarrassing position of having to postulate theories of living organisms, of living origins, which it could not demonstrate, of having to create a mythology of its own, namely the assumption that what could not be proved to take place today had in truth taken place in the primeval past." I'll give you some more of that later. You see, some of you are having a hard time with some of the things I'm saying. I know that. If you'll just be patient and listen with me throughout these two sessions or three sessions, you'll understand why I'm so irritated. Those of you that are a little bit annoyed maybe with what I'm saying, you just simply don't know all the facts. And if you did, you'd feel like you'd been really sold the Brooklyn Bridge. Beloved, before you right now, I'm going to demonstrate the mathematical probability of trying to create one protein that contains 100 amino acids. Now don't worry that you don't know what an amino acid is. I'll give you a brief idea of it. By random chance. Now, proteins are the fundamental building blocks of the cell. There is no such thing as one protein that's alive. The simplest that we know anything about is a cell of 239 proteins. I'm just trying to make something out of one. Furthermore, we know of no such thing as a living organism that has 100 amino acids. The simplest that we know anything of is about 445. I am trying to help the evolutionist out. I'm trying to help you believe it, okay? I'm trying to work it. And so by random chance, we're going to try and make one protein that has 100 amino acids. Now, amino acids are made up of chemical elements, mainly hydrogen and oxygen and carbon and sometimes some sulfur and nitrogen. And so they're made up, of course, of electrons, protons, neutrons, and things like that. So you can see when I write the word amino acid, I have really started us off with a big leap ahead. I am going to try, don't you see, to make something alive out of something that's dead. All I'm going to try and do is make one protein. Now to do this, let's see what we have to do. The mathematical odds to use 100 amino acids to build it, to make sure I have a mathematical certainty, I'll have to try 100 factorial times to do this thing. Let me tell you what I'm going to do. Let me come over here and tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to have to use electrons. In science, we say that there are 10 to the 80th electrons in the entire universe, known universe. That's what's been computed. You can find that in all the textbooks. Now, that means a 1 with 80 zeros after it. Now, that doesn't mean much to most of you. Let me try and teach you girls what a zero is. You girls work for me, okay? I hire you to do some work for me for $200 a week. You're worth more, but I'm a piker, okay? And I make a mistake on your salary of 1 0. I pay you $20. I just made it's only a zero, y'all. Now, you live on that this week. Oh, but I made a mistake the other way. and I paid you $2,000. Now maybe you understand. Now that's something to write home to Mama about. See, now you're beginning to get the idea of what 1-0 is. Suppose you worked for me for $200 a week, and I made an error of 3 zeros. And I gave you a paycheck of $20,000 for 1 week's work. Now are you beginning to understand what a zero is? They're biggies if they're on the left side of the decimal. Okay? Okay. Now 10 to the 9th is a billion. That's a 1 with 9 zeros. No one in this room comprehends that number. I don't, you don't. We say it, we use it. Not a single person that's ever lived really comprehends 1 billion separate entities. I forget now when it was. It hasn't been very long ago, but it's only been a little more than a billion minutes since Christ. And so, since I'm going to take 2 zeros, you see, to make the amino acids, I'm going to use 100, then I've got to reduce this to 10 to the 78th power. Now, why electrons? Why am I interested in electrons? Everybody's wondering. All right, because, I'm going to erase that and come back to it, because the basics for chemical reactions is electrons. Now, chemistry is simple, y'all. Chemistry is boys and girls, okay? Now, I'm going to keep everything non-technical. For any of you that have a scientific background, remember, I know better. I know to say energy level instead of orbit, but I'm going to keep everything bread and butter. Let me show you why we must talk about electrons. The basis for chemistry, the reason chemistry works, the reason we have chemical reactions is simple. Let this be the nucleus of an atom. And there are energy levels, and I'm going to use a Bohr atom, a simple Bohr atom for my example. They have electrons. Here's the nucleus. They have electrons that have minus charges in orbit. And the first energy level is filled up with 2. All other energy levels are unhappy. See, atoms, we're going to make people out of them. They're unhappy. Miserable life. He has an unfulfilled life. He's unhappy unless he can get 8 electrons in his outer orbit. And so here we have an atom with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Well, let's say him in 6. He's got 6 electrons in his outer orbit. That's an unhappy atom. Now, another thing about atoms is they all have the same number of protons in the nucleus. Now, protons have a plus charge in the nucleus. They have the same number of protons in the nucleus as they have electrons in orbit in total. So that all atoms are electrically neutral. Okay? Now, that's an unhappy atom. Why? He's got 6 in his outer orbit. He wants 8. The only exception to that, of course, is the first orbit. Well, over here is a little atom. Let's just draw her. Here we go with a little atom. There's the nucleus. Here's an energy level, an orbit, rather, with 2 electrons. And look here. I'll really go all out for this one. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 electrons in the second orbit. And in the third orbit, 1 electron. Unhappy and miserable. Wants 8, only has 1. There's 2 ways to do it. He can gain 7 or lose 1. Because if he loses 1, this orbit will, for all practical purposes, disappear. Which will make this gone, and he'll have 8 in what's left. Ah! Well, it's easier to lose 1 than gain 7. And so he looks over there and he looks at him and says, And he gives him his electron. Makes him happy. Now this orbit disappears, and his outer orbit has 8. But this one now has 1 more, but he's still not happy. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Son of a gun. But down here is another atom just like this second one. With 2 in the first orbit, 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 in the second orbit, and 1 in the third orbit. So, this one gives his. And now, everybody's happy. This one has 8 in his outer orbit. These outer orbits disappear. The third one and the second orbits in both of these have 8. Now, let's see what else happened. This is a goodie. Now, pay attention. You know, get a final exam tomorrow. Right? You graduate cum laude chemist. Now, look. If electrons have a minus charge, and if all atoms start off neutral, this atom has gained 2 minus charges. Therefore, what kind of charge does it have on it? -2, -2. Let's draw that. right here. Here he is, right here with a minus two charge. Now they're going to stick together. Why? Because opposites, it's boys and girls. Opposites attract. This one was electrically neutral. But he gave up a minus charge. So what kind of charge does he have now? A positive one, because he was the same number of pluses as minuses, and he lost a minus. So there it is, click, sticking on with that plus charge. But it had to get another one, and so here's this other one. And so you see, we've now formed a simple molecule. A molecule is more than one atom. And it's electrically neutral. All molecules are electrically neutral. Atoms that lose electrons or gain electrons, when they stay by themselves, are said to be ions. That's not important. Just thought I'd throw that out. So, here we have then marriage. What a man! Took two girls to satisfy him. Got one under each arm. I told you this was all about boys and girls. All right, so beloved, what have we said? The basis for chemistry, the basis for chemical reactions is the satisfying of the outer orbit. So we see that in chemical reactions, what we need are electrons. Okay? We're not interested in the center where the nucleus and the protons and neutrons are. That has to do with radioactivity. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes when we start talking about, in our second session, when we talk about what you've been told is, quote, scientific radioactive dating. When I get through telling you the truth about that, you're going to just throw up your hands. Okay? So, coming back to the problem, we've got 10 to the 78th electrons to try and make 100 amino acids to make one lousy protein by random chance. Now watch this. What do we have to do to make sure we have a mathematical certainty, an absolute mathematical certainty? How many times will we have to try? Look. Here's what we're going to do. Picture a ladder. Picture a ladder. We're going to cut the ladder right down the middle of the rungs, okay? And now we're going to try and fit it together. Now, you can see that it can only go together one way to be functional. I mean, you can only hook these things up one way to really make one protein that's a true protein. And if you fit the ladder wrong and try to climb up it, one side's tilted, and whoop, over you go. So we're going to try and fit it together, pull it apart. Try and fit it together, pull it apart. How many times would we have to do that to make sure we had an absolute mathematical certainty? The answer to that is 100, because we're using 100 amino acids. And actually, the truth is, I have extremely simplified this. I will show you the actual mathematical odds in a moment. 100 factorial. Now, that scares you girls. That exclamation part meaning factorial, that's so easy. Look, 4 factorial is 1 times 2 times 3 times 4. That's what factorial means. See, I told you it's easy. Nothing to this math and science stuff. See, chemistry, you've become a chemist. Now you're about to be a cum laude graduate in mathematics. So 1 times 2 is 2, times 3 is 6, times 4 is 24. So 100 factorial is 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 times 5 times 6 times 7 times 8 times 9 times 10, all the way to 100. Believe it or not, it's a whopping number. The answer to that, and if you don't believe it, you can figure it out for yourself. The answer is 10 to the 158th power. A 1 with 158 zeros after it. Now remember, I told you, you don't even comprehend 10 with 9 zeros, a billion. Every zero makes a fantastic difference. All right, are you ready? How many times? I'm going to try and make it. I'm going to try and make it. Now look. How many times am I going to try and stick this thing together, this ladder back together so it'll fit? I'm going to be generous. I'm going to try 1 billion times a second. Now, anyone that doesn't think that's generous, 1 billion times a second. I'm going to try and put it together and pull it apart, put it together and pull it apart, because it didn't work. Now, a billion is 10 to the ninth. So I'm going to try 10 to the ninth second. So 10 to the 78th times 10 to the ninth. How long will I try this? 5 billion years, like they tell us the Earth is in age? Oh, we can't wait to tell you how we determined that it was that old. You just won't believe it. No. Science tells us the age of the universe is 30 billion years. I'm going to be generous and try for 30 billion years at a billion times a second to stick this thing together. 100 amino acids, trying every way I can to stick it together. the only way it'll fit to make one lousy protein. Now, it's not going to be alive, mind you. I mean, a protein is not alive. It takes at least 445 amino acids in a protein consisting of 239 proteins to make one cell. That's equal to one living cell. That's the simplest living cell known to man. Is 239 proteins, each one consisting of 445 amino acids, each one consisting of chemical elements of hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, etc., which are consisting of protons, neutrons, electrons. Now, this is going to shock you. Do you know how many seconds there are in 30 billion years? This will give you an idea of how big a zero is. There's only 10 to the 18th seconds in 30 billion years. So this is tries per second. Now, let's multiply that. Now, fellas, girls, the way you multiply exponents, those are called exponents, 10 to the 78th times 10 to the 9th times 10 to the 18th, is you add them. And the answer is 10 to the 105th. But we had to have 10 to the 158th to have a mathematical certainty that it would work. Someone says, well, you came close. Let's see. The difference between 10 to the 158th and 10 to the 105 is 158 minus 105 equals 10 to the 53rd power against. In other words, a 1 with 53 zeros. You ever play poker? Ever go to Las Vegas, see the big boys go at it? Blackjack? Would you bet your life and soul in a poker hand where you knew the odds against you of winning that hand was 1 billion to 1 against you? Would you try it? That's 10 with 9 zeros. The odds against that one lousy protein is 10 to the 53rd power to 1 against. Now, as if that's not bad enough, say, hey, don't you understand? It is an insult to my intelligence for someone to ram this theory down my throat. And these geologists that keep trying to ram it down my throat don't know the first thing about this, but I want to take up for some of them. It's sheer ignorance. They don't know anything about math. And they just philosophize. I know I was one of them. I have the right to say it. I'm just an honest one. I did it on ego trips. Are you beginning to get to the idea of how ridiculous this is? Now, you want to see how ridiculous it really is? Even if it had worked, it's got to be able to reproduce itself, or it dies. And you're back to the drawing board. All right, now then, I'd like to really sum this up and come to the point and make it forever done mathematically. On the computers, we have been told that the odds of the simplest protein molecule that could reproduce itself arising by chance, random chance, still not being a living cell, just a replicating protein molecule, that the mathematical odds of that ever happening by random chance are 1/2 to the 1500th power, which is equivalent to the base 10 of 10 to the 450th power, a 1 with 450 zeros after it. Now, if you can just do that little bit of math for yourself. I'm throwing that out. You can find that in different textbooks. But any mathematician in here can quickly check to see if 1/2 to the 1500th power is 10 to the 450th by just doing little logarithms. Now, see, the point I'm going to get at is this. In order to ensure, by random chance, that you could get a simple protein molecule that could reproduce itself, just a replicating protein molecule, the odds against it are 10 to the 450th to 1. Now, the geologist, the evolutionist, says, oh, just give us enough time, and we can do anything. Give us enough time and evolution will happen. I'm going to give you all the time you'd ever need. Now listen carefully. They tell us that the universe is possibly 30 billion years old, that that's the age possibly of the known universe. Let's multiply that times 100, all right? Times 100. I'm going to give them their 30 billion years for the whole universe for evolution to take place, the age of the universe they estimate, and I'm going to multiply that times 100. All right, in other words, 3,000 billion years. Now, if you'll just do a little math, that will come out to be 10 to the 20th seconds
Okay? Now, the known universe is 5 billion light years in radius. That's the size. All the electrons you could possibly pack into that, again, it has been computed, is 10 to the 130th. So you've got to have electrons to have chemical reactions to take place. So I'm giving them all the electrons that you could pack into the whole universe. I'm giving them 3,000 billion years for this to happen. And how many times will we try it this time? Well, before I said, let's try it 1 billion times a second. To stick this ladder together, pull it apart, stick it together, pull it apart. To make it fit by random chance, and if it doesn't fit, you pull it apart and try again. How many times a second will we try? Well, this time, let's say, 1 billion times a second. Would you say that's fair? 1 billion times a second. That's 10 to the 18th power. Okay, would you think that that's good enough? Oh, let's multiply that times 100 just to make sure that nobody complained, because they keep saying if they've got enough time, it'll happen. I'm giving them 3,000 billion years with all the electrons to fool with in the whole, that you could pack into the whole universe, and I'm going to give them 1 billion tries a second, and I'll multiply that times 100. In other words, 10 to the 20th tries per second for each particle. So that this would be the total number of events that could ever occur in all the universe in all time, which is 10 to the 20th times 10 to the 20th times 10 to the 130th, which is 10 to the 170th. You add the exponents together. And so, but to make it absolutely work, to be sure mathematically that we did get a replicating protein by random chance, we had to get an answer of 10 to the 450th. So 10 to the 450th minus 10 to the 170th is 10 to the 280th to 1 against. That is the mathematical odds. A 10 with 280 zeros after it to 1. Now remember, 10 to the 9th is 1 billion. So the point, beloved, is this. The probability is absolute zero when the numbers are that big. But I have now given the total number of events that could ever occur in all the universe in all time. I have now, by that simple illustration, reduced evolution to sheer mathematical and philosophical nonsense. It takes religion and faith of the greatest magnitude to now believe in such a dogma. Do you understand the force and the magnitude of what I have just said? Someone says, well, Brother Floyd, don't you think God gave us a mind to use to study and dig into all this? Oh, God gave us a mind, all right. But the Bible tells us what He gave us a mind for. In Matthew chapter 11, verse 29, Jesus said, I gave it to you so you could learn of me. Hallelujah. That's what it's for communicating with God, for learning about God and worshiping God and praising God. And we've used it to do away with God, professing ourselves to be wise. We have become utter fool. So again, the explanation that is offered by the evolutionist on the creation of life, you know, says that, well, many billions of years ago in the middle of the ocean or some primeval ocean, there was an atmosphere of ammonia and methane and hydrogen and water vapor. And then some energy source, such as an electrical discharge or shock wave or something, came in and generated amino acids by random chance. These amino acids finally formed into proteins, and the protein is the basic building block of the cell. And then these proteins came together in the correct arrangement, and all of this happened by random chance. Now, I've tried to show you that there's already many aspects of this process that are incredibly improbable, and that the whole thing is fallacious. But there's something else we ought to know. You see, even if that could possibly somehow mysteriously have happened, they're still on the horns of a dilemma. Number one, if that had happened by random chance in nature, the Earth's atmosphere probably would have contained free oxygen, which would have oxidized the organic chemical compound as soon as it formed. In other words, as soon as that cell came alive, it would be oxidized by free oxygen. And to you laymen, that just simply means it would have been killed. It would chemically have been broken down. So, okay, you say, well, maybe there wasn't any free oxygen. Okay, in that case, if there was no free oxygen in the atmosphere, then any life that was formed would have been destroyed by the sun's unfiltered ultraviolet radiation. Because unfiltered ultraviolet radiation ruptures the chemical bonds in protoplasm. It would have immediately been a reversible reaction. It would have broken down. The only reason we have any life on Earth today is because we're shielded from the direct ultraviolet radiation by a blanket of ozone. Now, the third thing that should be considered is that the mathematical probability of forming one protein molecule by chance, a French scientist named Dunoy calculated it to be 1 out of 10 to the 243rd power. There was a Swiss mathematician named Guy who calculated it on his computer, and he got 10 to the 160th power to 1 against. And Dr. Murray Eden of MIT and Dr. Marcel Schutzenberger of the University of Paris both concluded that their digital computer showed that evolution was, for all practical purposes, impossible from a mathematical standpoint. Now, those first two obstacles would definitely put the evolutionists on the horns of a dilemma. But the third obstacle really reduces evolution from science to a religion, because one would have to have incredible faith, faith of immense proportions, in order to overcome the overwhelming evidence of mathematical probability opposing evolution. I think it's important that we understand that part of the Bible-science conflict is due to the fact that we don't recognize that the domain of science is primarily in the present and involves the investigation of present-day phenomenon. The Bible-science controversy is mostly limited to the interpretation of the past. Now, if the scientists would understand that their big domain is the present, that's what they can see, smell, taste, and touch, and that for the most part, that's what the scientific method is involved in dealing with, that would alleviate part of the problem. What we really have is a conflict between the present generally accepted, quote, scientific interpretation of Earth history as opposed to the biblical record of Earth history. Speaking from a purely scientific point of view, the past has very little to do with what we call today science. Of course, there's a lot of people that hear what I say and they say, well, the problem's always been the problem with the church. The church said that the stars were all centered around the earth, and there was the Ptolemaic system, and that the church was in the way of science, and it proved out to be wrong. But you see, that's not the way it really happened at all. The incident that concerning Galileo has been totally misunderstood. See, because it's normally presented as a case where the Bible and the church were out of phase with science and obstructed science because of dogmatism. But the truth is that Ptolemy was a Greek. He was neither Jew nor Christian. His geocentric system was not based upon biblical teaching nor evidence. His system became the scientific dogma of the establishment of that day. And when Copernicus and Galileo suggested that the geocentric system was wrong, they found themselves fighting against the establishment. The established scientific community then used the Bible and the church to exert pressure upon Galileo to renounce his scientific beliefs. This geometric theory was not based upon the Bible. Christians had allowed the Bible to be accommodated to fit the current dogma in science. And my question is, isn't that what we're trying to do today? Trying to fit the Bible into the worldly scheme of things. Direct our attention for a little bit to the subject of radiometric dating. The question comes to every one of us: how old is the earth? How old is the universe? Is the Bible account correct, or is the scientific account correct? And if the scientific account isn't correct, why isn't it correct? And why do we believe what we believe? And why do the textbooks say what they say? Fair enough. I would like to now show you how it was first determined that the earth was older, considerably older than the Bible account, which would lead us to put an age on the earth of approximately 6,000 years, at least since Adam. The way this was first done and the brilliant scientific method that was used is simply as follows. We took indirect measurements to measure the size of the ocean. And having determined the volume of the ocean, roughly, we measured many places to see how much salt was in the ocean. We then went to many rivers and measured how fast salt was flowing down those rivers to the ocean. And we, quote, number one, assume the original ocean had no salt. It's quite an assumption. I mean, how do you know? Number two, we assumed that the rivers around the world had always carried salt to the ocean at the exact same rate they were carrying it today. That's quite an assumption.
And we therefore calculated how long it would take to fill up the ocean with salt, if the original ocean had no salt. And the answer?
Actually, the first time we measured the salt to the sea, we got 100 million years. But then they knew that wasn't anywhere near long enough evolution to take place. So they began to fudge factor the data that they had, and they were able to push it back 300 million years. Now, even the most diehard evolutionist realizes that that's not nearly enough time for evolution to have taken place. So they tried a new technique. They began to measure the sediment to sea instead of salt to sea, checking to see how long the geological column could have taken to be deposited. It's been calculated that if you took an ideal cross-section of the geologic column, in other words, all the rocks that have ever been laid down one on top of the other, if it was ever present all in one place, it's been estimated that it would be between 80 to 100 miles of deposit, of sediment. So in other words, at the present rate, at the uniform rate of debris, sediment being deposited at the ocean basins today, how long would it have taken to build up a column of rock, the 80 to 100 miles thick? And that allowed them to push the date back much, much greater. Finally, they ended up, after pushing back and pushing back and fudge factoring here and there.
And the answer was somewhere between 3 to 5 billion years old. Now, the only reason anyone would have ever tried that in the first place is because they didn't believe in God in the first place. See, if they'd believed in God in the first place, they wouldn't have even tried something like that. They already had the answer. Okay? Now, it's true that the dates in Bishop Usher's book that you see in the King James Bible there are not accurate, but they're not so far off. I have myself taken Scripture and gone back, and I believe that you can date Adam probably less than 100 years of error, certainly more, less than 200 years of error, with some very simple scriptures. It's really not difficult. Now, it's very difficult to get the exact date after 721 B.C. Dates in the Bible are subject to error only because, not dates in the Bible, because they're not in there like that, but I mean Bishop Usher's dates, because kings in the Bible, for instance, say I was a king and I ruled for 20 months and died. Part of 1 year, all of another year, and part of the third year. They give me credit for ruling 3 years because they wanted to venerate me, you see. And so then they would give the same king credit for ruling 2 years because they rule part of 2 years. Also, David's a good example. David, for about 2 years, when he was still alive, Solomon was actually ruling. Now the question is, when it said David ruled 40 years, did it mean he ruled 40 years before Solomon? Or did it count the overlap where Solomon was ruling 2 years while David was still alive? And it says Solomon also ruled 40 years. So did they both rule 40-40? Or did the last 2 years overlap? Is a problem. King Uzziah became a leper. His son Jotham ruled for about 10 years. And the question is, when it gave them credit for how long they ruled, did it give Uzziah those 10 years when he was a leper or not? So there's, in the Kings, it's difficult, in the book of Kings. Other than that, it's not really that difficult. You have been told that we have dated the rocks with radioactive methods, and therefore, it's a fact. When you have seen books with geological columns in it, and out here it'll use words like the Pleistocene, it'll use words like the Eocene, it'll use words like the Cretaceous, and it'll use words which was about 120 million years ago. Now, that's what, out here's 120 million, Pleistocene's about, well, they're moving it back now, but because they're finding some new finds, but say between 1 million, 3 million years, and then you go back into the something called the Paleozoic, and you got a period of time in there called the Mississippian, which was about 300 million years ago, million years ago. Finally back to the Cambrian, which is supposed to be 500 million years ago, etc. Now the question is, how did they get those dates? You have been led to believe that we did it with radioactive dating. That is a lie. We never did a single one with radioactive dating. Every textbook had those numbers written in it before we knew the first thing about radioactive dating. You want to know how we did it?
We measured the salt going to the sea and decided the earth was 3 to 5 billion years old. We accepted that evolution was true. We believed it. We did not have the facts to prove it. We accepted it. And when I get through, you'll see what I mean about facts. And so we sat down and philosophized and decided how long, if we've got 5 billion years to use, how long would it take from a horse to go to this stage and to this stage and this stage? And when we got the wrong answer, you know, we ended up with too many going way on out here. Well, we tried again until we fit it into this 5 billion years. And we published it. And at first, we didn't publish it as a fact. We just said, you know, possible. Or this is a framework. But every year that the arguments went by, those numbers became fixed and fixed. And miracle of miracles, now that we have radioactive dating, can you believe not a single one of those dates has ever changed? I'm telling you, almost every rock in the world was already dated before we ever knew one thing about radioactive dating, and we hadn't changed the date on a single one of them, hardly. Isn't that amazing science? Oh, those must have been the most brilliant men that ever lived to have actually just figured it out so accurately. Let's talk about radioactive dating. Now, I know the one you want to talk about is carbon-14, but that's going to be the last one, the finale. What I'm saying is, not that these things aren't there, it's these years are complete garbage, and I totally reject every one of them by the millions and billions. And I'll show you why I do. I would like to first discuss, very briefly, but enough that you can get the point, that there are several. Now, let's talk about how we use radioactive dating. Anything that has a periodic function is a clock. A periodic function means tick, tick, tick. Your heart is a clock. It goes boom, boom, boom. And if you just sit there, we can time and make a clock by you. We could even keep up with how many hours we're in a day. We could make a whole calendar based on your clock, your heart, as long as you don't get too excited and get that thing running away, see. All right? Now, we talked about atoms before, and the nucleus of an atom is composed largely of protons, which have a plus charge, and neutrons, which are neutral. Now, remember we learned that atoms were unhappy because of the number of electrons? Well, because they wanted 8 in their outer orbit, except for the inner orbit, which had 2. The nucleus of atoms are unhappy too. Unless they have nearly a ratio of 1 to 1 of protons to neutrons. In other words, if it's got 10 protons, it would like to get nearly 10 neutrons to be happy. Got that? So, if we had an atom that, let's say, for example, had 7 protons and say it had 13 neutrons, he is miserable. And so, he'll start trying to do something about it. He would be called radioactive. He will emit, because you see, neutrons basically are composed of a proton and a neutron. A proton and an electron. And so, he will either emit things called beta particles, which are high-speed electrons. He kicks it out. And when he kicks it out from a neutron, look what he would be left as. A proton. So, if he lost a beta particle, a high-speed electron would sail out of the center of this atom, he would gain, in effect, 1 proton, for one of his neutrons would have been converted to a proton. So that he would then have 8 protons and only 12 neutrons. He's getting happier. Got it? Got it. Now, he might emit an alpha particle, which is composed, it's really a helium nucleus, and it's 2 protons to neutrons. We're going to lose a lot of weight. Boy, he's going to really change up a lot on that. Or he might emit a gamma particle, which is a high-energy X-ray. And so anything that does this is said to be radioactive. And the reason they're radioactive, they're not happy. They've not got a near 1 to 1. And they'd like to get, say, 7 to 7 or 7 to 8. That'd be pretty close. And become what we call stable. Got it? You got it. Now, uranium-238... The 238 is the total number of protons and neutrons. That's the weight. Okay? And this is radioactive. He's got a lot more neutrons and protons, and so he wants to get about the same, so he begins to kick out particles. And he kicks out, and he becomes one element, and he becomes another element, another. I could give you the whole thing, but it's, you know, forget it. Finally, down here at the bottom, he becomes lead, which the symbol is PB, lead 206, stable. It's almost one-to-one, and it's not unhappy anymore, all right? Now, we measure things we call half-lives. Now, these terms are big, but I think, as you'll see, everything's so simple. We have measured, and I'll talk about that, that the half-life of uranium-238 is 4.5 billion years. How do we know nobody's lived that long? I mean that. So what we mean by that is, if we had however much that is, say that's 10 pounds of lead, of uranium-238, that after 4.5 billion years, half of it would be lead-206 now. And other parts of it would still be some of this, some of these other elements, intermediate elements. So, after 4.5 more billion years, half of what was left will be converted. And after 4.5 billion years more, half of what was left, 4.5 billion years, half of what was left, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Got it? That's what we mean by half-lives. And so, we can measure how much has been converted. And if we had something that added up to be 10 pounds, and half of it was lead, and half was uranium-238, we would say it was 4.5 billion years old. I think you get the general gist. And so uranium, the uranium-thorium, either one, to lead is one method. Another method is called the potassium-argon method. That is a method most commonly used to date rocks. We'll discuss it. And then there is the rubidium-strontium method. Okay, those are the three major methods that we use in dating rocks, because rocks are old, supposedly. Let me now tell you what the three basic assumptions are for all radioactive dating. Are you ready for this, Tom? Now, each method has its own peculiar assumptions that are made. I'm only going to tell you three that are true for every method of radioactive dating. Basic assumption number one, you're not going to believe it.